structure.
I think it's just a very key year. I think by the time we done this, and it was there, all of a sudden we didn't find out that it was revising all the.
Yeah.
Technically, I have 6 weeks, and I'll say.
Oh, I have.
Coming up.
Maybe I call.
I just dragged you down.
It would be in our area, it would be in some other area.
Bad enough, and it makes a relationship. Does anybody else have anything to add on the more or less philosophical discussion we were having before we had a break? Or anything specific? If not, I'd like to entertain a motion directing Professor Arthur in regard to this draft. Somebody mentioned that we should recommend Section 1 and hold in abeyance the recommendation on Section 2, but redraft it along the lines of the discussion that Professor Arthur can discern what those lines are, maybe along the various lines of discussion. Would that be helpful to you, Don, if we had that sort of direction?
Well, yes, but it's certainly what the committee wants to do on this.
Right.
I think the purposes of moving ahead on this and giving the reporter some guidelines, like your suggestion, Mr. Midland.
Do we automatically exclude the classification on felony levels? Does this exclude that we're going to have classes of felonies?
No. Oh, no.
Those derive from the punishment rather than from the major classification.
That sentencing matter should be treated in another part of the code, as I understand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt, or we recommend that the full commission tentatively approve Section 1, and further that we defer any further consideration of Section 2 until.
Takes us to the other draft, does it, or is there something more on
this? Yes, I think it's item 3 on the agenda. This draft is in a booklet, we'll say, I think, and it starts out purposes and principles of construction. Those are the two subjects covered by it.
these purposes are very much like those in the New York and Michigan draft. They are considerably shorter than the model penal code.
I think they are realistic, and I think they're necessary.
The model penal code says, among other things, that it's one of the purposes of the draft to adopt and implement recent scientific findings in regard to the treatment of persons convicted of crime, and I'm all for that. But I think this is just a roadblock to getting a code adopted by the legislature, and that there would be screams that it sounds like a do-gooder statement, so I have left that out. I have included something that the model penal code does not have, that is to say, to ensure the public safety by preventing the commission of offenses through the deterrent influence of the sentences authorized, the correction and rehabilitation of those convicted, and their confinement when required in the interest of public protection. I included those not because I'm vindictive, but because I think that most people feel that those are purposes of a penal code, and that you can't very well get one adopted without those expressions. Things such as to give a fair warning of the nature of the conduct declared to constitute an offense and of the sentences authorized upon a conviction, I think that just makes good sense and repeats what much of the case law is. C, I think, is terribly important, and we haven't got to it yet, but we will be getting to it in the next draft, to define the act or omission and the accompanying mental state that constitute each offense and limit the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault. I think one of the greatest difficulties we have in present criminal law that just grows like topsy neva is terms such as willfully and maliciously, and crimes where there is no mental element stated, and that all of that kind of thing needs desperately to be clarified so that you know precisely where you stand, what are the elements of the offense, not only as far as the act or omission, but as far as the accompanying mental state is concerned. Now, this draft says, limit the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault. I think the model penal code goes further than that and would simply prevent the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault. But there is now so much in the law that does penalize conduct without fault that I don't think we can state as a purpose to entirely get away from it. I suppose that the penalization of conduct that is without fault is learned in the situations where the legislature feels who's kidding who. Maybe you can't prove it precisely, but that it undoubtedly exists. But certainly the purpose of a code should be to limit as strongly as possible situations where conduct that is without fault.
Give an example of that?
Criminal.
What would be an example?
Some of the narcotics offenses might be considered as conduct that is criminal without fault. But the public says, well, this is terrible conduct, and it isn't without fault.
Yeah,
well, I could take an example of
that meeting with
Richard.
Carelessness
may be,
or not, depending on where you left it,
should be
the prohibition
is
flatly and
then you leave
the
door. Regardless of the mental state. Yeah.
Well,
the term without fault, what's that?
Yeah,
that's, I mean, if you say that, I mean, this is what amounts to such negligence that it becomes criminal, it is with fault, whether it's whether it's with intent or not.
Well, I think that the purpose of a code should be to lay it on the line and say what the mental element is. And if no mental element is stated, or if it is not stated that there is criminality in the absence of a mental element, then one of the four or three, whatever you want to phrase it, stated mental elements in the general principles of liability would have to be found by the court before there could be liability. So at least you know where you stand. This is anticipating the argument that we'll have when we have that draft before us. Perhaps it's impossible to anticipate it in this way. Now, as far as principles of construction is concerned, our present law does away with the principle of strict construction that was the common law, and the common law that the criminal statute was to be strictly construed in favor of the accused. And our statute does away with that proposition, and our Supreme Court has pretty much carried out the statute, but unfortunately in many states where such a statute exists, the courts nevertheless go merrily on strictly construing the statute in favor of the accused. Again, I'm not being vindictive, I'm simply saying that the legislature legislative intent should be carried out. And the formulation here is pretty much model penal code, New York and Michigan. The rule of the penal statute is to be strictly construed, shall not apply to this code or any of its provisions. All provisions of this code shall be construed according to the fairness or according to their terms to promote justice. This is pretty much what the Oregon law is today. And then we go ahead and say, and to effect the purposes stated in subsection 1 of this section, which goes a little beyond what the present law is. Now, there may be some drafting terminology here that Kathleen would suggestively change in order to accomplish the same purposes. That's about what I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Along the lines that Courtney is pursuing, there is somewhat of a contradiction in terms between the sub B, to give fair warning, and the strict construction, that is, there is to be strict construction in that if the courts become so liberal in their construction, then fair warning is not given to the accused in the way that the court construes the act. I'm not alarmed by it. I think we ought to talk about it. Because I think that the court ought to have the leeway of the construing the act in the light of justice and the light of fair import of terms. What we're doing in this case, then, is casting ourselves upon the discretion of the court not to violate the fair warning provision that we've stated as one of the principles. I think we can all see that a court could construe a statute so liberally that the defendant could not have been said to have fair warning of what the crime was.
This is a criticism that's been made of this formulation, and yet I think that it's a very proper and very necessary one.
I can see
the criminal statutes that would nail a person without really warning them what he's going to be nailed with.
I have a question. Going back to 1 sub C, where you talk about limit to condemnation. Conduct of criminal lines without fault. Would there be any present substantive crimes in Oregon which would violate the spirit of that language?
Contributing statutory rape.
In other words, well, it's
true. The fair warning part?
What?
About the fair warning?
No, the sub C. Sorry.
Crimes against children and gentlemen.
Limit the condemnation of conduct of criminal crime without fault. I wonder if there is any present specific substantive crime that. For example,
involuntary manslaughter.
For example, negligent homicide.
Well, that requires gross negligence, so this is fault.
Well, but. Gross negligence can be a conscious indifference to the rights of others, whatever that means.
It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, I'm perhaps speaking up too freely. It seems to me that this, as we go ahead with the drafting, that this will be a recognizable kind of fault. This will fit under one of the mental elements. That what the code in this C is seeking to put a brake on. It's situations where you punish a person rather severely for conduct where he is in truth simply without fault because we think there's a public interest that's so strong that we're going to do this now.
How about statutory rape?
Now the present formulation in regard to statutory rape proceeds something along these lines that there really is a kind of fault. Statutory rape, but even though I didn't know that this young lady was under the age, the conduct, even though if the facts had been as I believe them to be, the conduct is nevertheless immoral or meretricious, therefore it isn't really without fault. Now the modern versions, like California, for instance, say that there should be a defense in the state of fact, Hernandez case. But I don't think that is precisely what this
well,
is getting
but,
at.
But I take it that you wouldn't think that the language of sub C would, for example, cast the statutory rape statute into outer darkness as far as the general principles of this code.
It wasn't intended to, and I don't think it does.
He knows that it uses the word limit rather than prohibit.
Yeah.
I think that helps a little bit for the vision out there. Right. Because you're still going to run it. I thought the other one transport Christmas trees without a bill of sale.
What was it?
Transporting Christmas trees. Christmas trees without a fulfilled sale is crime, or
yeah, they didn't
have
six months to do it.
Yeah, but whether or not the, you know, how much fault involved or oversight, but it's intended because of the prima facie case that you stole.
Well, it's a Santa Claus Act.
Yeah. And they, you know, they did the same thing now with the junk.
I really can't cite you, and this is just, there are several in scattered through the statutes. Here's building a road through a cemetery, and I rather imagine that it probably doesn't state any mental health to go with it, but
well, I take it that when you use the word limit, however, you would still have the legislature look at particular statutes and decide whether or not they were not within the spirit of these principles.
Yes. Hopefully that we didn't constantly go further and further in the line of substantial sentences for conduct that is actually without fault.
Well, I think a good one vagrancy. Crime status. There's no fault in being a poor man and the other is a crime. And that also is the fair warning problem. And the common law nuisance doctrine, which is enacted in statute here in Oregon, could fall under perhaps both categories, fair warning and this crime without fault.
It may not be a crime by the time we finish our work.
Well, yeah, right. I agree. I know hot vagrancy ought not to be a crime, but that's not a modern view.
I was just going to say, in other sections of the code, under regulation of all sorts of businesses, the insurance code, the real estate code, securities, aren't there hundreds of sections which make criminal acts which a person would not know unless he was a lawyer, perhaps? Well, then we just have a Supreme Court case where it was selling securities, I think, that was under advisement. And we've got many, many of these here, but there is no fault on it. You don't know what type of security this is, whether it falls within the prohibition of the statute. You don't know that you have to have a license in order to sell real estate. So I don't, perhaps there aren't so many of these in the regular criminal code section, but wouldn't we eliminate many, many of these for this?
I don't think it's the intention to eliminate them. I think it's simply the status as one of the purposes of this code to limit the condemnation of conduct of criminal matters without fault. My statement and my explanation for this statement is not mine. It's the Oregon Commission. But my explanation of it is certainly weak. It's my desire in using that language to point out to the legislature, look, don't go very far in that direction. You constantly go further than you perhaps should. Not to strike down what exists, but to try and put a brake on what is done in the future.
Well, what you said before, I think is perhaps part of the explanation, is where there is one of these public welfare offenses, like selling without a license, or where there's no intent at all in the statute now, will necessitate inserting a provision. Am I correct in this?
Yes.
In those statutes, wherever they may be outside the code, that there is to be no mental element. So that the legislature's attention will have to be focused on the particular problem, whether or not there should be a particular criminal mens rea or something similar to it. Rather than the broadcast way that some legislatures are cranking out these public welfare.
If you have an offense defined by the statute under the new code, which says that if one intentionally does something, or if one recklessly does something, or if one knowingly does something, or one negligently does something, okay, no strain. If you draw up a new statute prohibiting certain conduct and omit a statement of mental element, one of those three or four mental elements, then by the omission of them, it would be the policy of this code to require that one of them be proved. But if you don't require, the legislature has really thought and doesn't wish that any such elements be required, it should say so.
Merely by omitting it? Or
no, not by omitting it. Omitting it will require it to be proved. But you must come right out and say that this is a without fault proposition.
Well, that Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Do we have to amend all every section of the code that contains one of these prohibitions?
Point well taken. I didn't have it in mind that one should, that this would apply.
Well, I think it would, and I think it's meant to.
Well, I disagree.
Well, you don't have to amend them. They can stay as they are, but they would still come under the influence, I believe, would be good.
Isn't this the purposes of this thing, principles of construction, applying only to our, this will be like chapter 161 of the criminal code, and not necessarily apply to all the regulatory ones?
So one says the purpose, the general purposes of the provisions of this code, meaning the criminal code, that's what we're talking about. Certainly these other things are going to be affected if ones, some of these regulatory statutes that have penalty provisions in them. I think that that's beyond the scope. When we start talking about amending all these other collateral statutes and ORS, we're talking about the purposes of the provisions of this code. I don't think we're talking about the purposes of the provisions of the Oregon Revised Statutes.
Well,
are we?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is another thing that we're going to have to face, that you're going to have to face. The Model Penal Code says that the provisions of Part 1 of the Code are applicable to offenses defined by other statutes, unless the Code otherwise provides. And the New York and Michigan drafts also say something like that. They say this: unless expressly stated otherwise, or unless the context otherwise requires, provisions of this chapter shall govern the construction and punishment of any offense defined outside this chapter and committed after the effective date of this chapter, as well as the construction and application of any defense to a prosecution for such offense.
But I think that's why they've used language. Now, the Model Penal Code says to safeguard, and I think Illinois says to limit condemnation. And there isn't language in any of these that says to prevent or forbid condemnation of conduct without fault and credit.
No, that's
in
true.
Other words, this would give direction and guidance as far as the application of these provisions outside of the code. I can answer Judge Rodman's question. I think it's the same question we got into at the last subcommittee meeting, is whether or not it's beyond the scope of this, of the Criminal Law Revision Commission, to revise all of these statutes in ORS.
Well, I did not intend to revise them. Now, George feels that this language would revise them, so we have a difference of opinion.
Let's make it clear that we're not subject to what we said last time, that we don't intend to get into all the 990 sections. I thought that was one of the reasons why we asked Kathleen to compile, was to see what kind of a problem we had, but not with the thought that we would revise all
of them. You have those in your books, I think, you know.
Certainly seems to me that the principles of purpose and principles of instruction that we ought to adopt are for the criminal code, not for the real estate code or the refrigerator code or anything else.
Well, but the fact is that a lot of the 990 sections, as I read them, Kathleen, am I correct, make misdemeanors of a lot of these welfare offenses.
I agree to the extent that
if they are a crime, then we are dealing with crimes in the code.
To the extent that our classification of matters as misdemeanors and so on, as carrying certain penalties and so on, will have to be consistent with those 990 sections, or vice versa, or some accommodation reached. But in terms of construction of codes, I certainly don't think that we can get into principles of construction of the real estate code.
Then,
I wonder what effect your failure to consider the regulatory statutes might have on the inclusion of the unlawful act, it being valid to say or valid to prohibit. When you're given the question of voluntary or involuntary manslaughter.
I get that.
Well, you're going to leave out this vast body of regulatory law here. You then have the problem of involuntary manslaughter, let's say. Let's assume that someone's committed an act in violation of the refrigerator code, left the door open. You don't know what the intent is, the requirement of intent in that statute. An unlawful act has been committed. A child has died. You're preparing to draft an indictment. Is that not on the say, not on the prohibit? Does it make any difference?
Have any comment on that?
I just asked a question. It could.
Well, you're talking about cases where you're indicted for manslaughter.
State versus Trent seems to talk about Malibu say, but I don't know.
Then, assuming the 1971 legislature passes an act to make certain conduct criminal, is whether it's going to be interpreted under this section would be decided by where the compiler of the code places it in the building.
Chairman?
Yeah, it seems to me that we've got now, under the present statutory organization, we've got some extremely serious conduct, which is dealt with in the criminal court's custom, which might better be in the criminal code and is not now. The narcotics offenses, for instance, some of the reckless driving under the influence, this kind of thing, might well be within in the criminal code. This is, we're going to have a problem along these lines all the time.
Just an example of that is refrigerator crime. We're citing, we spent at least a week bouncing that around the office and finally did compile it in the criminal law, somewhat to my objection. That point. I can't remember where I want to put it, but I had another idea. But this is a difficulty. If you create a criminal code and govern it by certain rules of construction, then only a crime that is added to and made a part of that code is similarly going to be governed by that. And Judge Rodman observed, well, that's a legislative decision. It is. Certainly, if somebody remembers at the moment that they're drafting this crime and they made a packet to remind them that they should add it to and make it a part of, but if you look through the code, you will notice how often something has been intended to be part of the insurance code or part of this or part of that, and doesn't in fact get added to it. Therefore, you have the possibility of all kinds of enactments. This is just a practical kind of thing that would be straggling around in a category of limbo that appeared to be technically part of the criminal code but had not had the right magic incantation set over so that it became part of it.
Well, I think I would support that idea that the entire statutes ought to be examined for any criminal penalty in light of the intentional element or the public welfare element.
I got a question. What really throws us into the real problem as far as all the other regulatory offenses, all the 990 section, is George's statement that in order for there to be criminal liability without the mens rea, that it's got to be specifically stated. And how do you interpret this to mean this statement that it's got to be specifically stated that there's criminal liability without fault? And I don't like the word fault because there's. But how do you feel that this statement here means that there's going to have to be a specific statement in the definition of the crime, say, leaving a refrigerator door open, that you are guilty of this offense even though you don't intentionally or negligently do it?
That's right. I'd like to respond to that, if I may, by the model penal code, by saying that this part of the code really does not say that, but that I'm looking forward now to the general principles of liability in section 2.02 of the model penal code. And I'm not saying that we will adopt it, but I'm urging it to be strongly considered. Minimum requirements of culpability, except as provided in section 205, a person is not guilty of an offense unless he acted purposely, knowingly, recklessly, or negligently, as the law may require, with respect to each material element of the offense. And then they define each of these mental elements. And then going over to 205, let's see what it says there. When culpability requirements are inapplicable to violations and to offenses defined by other statutes, effective absolute liability in reducing greater offense to violation
the requirements of culpability prescribed by sections 2.01 and 2.02 do not apply to, and they give a long list of situations where they do not apply. Another part of the code we would have to specifically say is we're dealing now with a section that is intertwined with a section to be considered at a
next meeting. That's because I couldn't see where this actually
it doesn't precisely here, but a later section will.
I'm somewhat inclined to think, actually, Chairman, that the principle, the purposes we have, and the principles of construction that we feel we ought to adopt, we may very well, when we've completed our work, want to come back and take another look at them, because when we have done major part of the, both the substantive and other parts, we might well find that some of the principles we've talked about here aren't the ones we really want. Some of the purposes aren't the ones we really want. I suppose you have to start somewhere with a guiding philosophy, perhaps.
I can see what you mean. For instance, in section 2G, we are going to seems to me have very little safeguard, perhaps, against disproportionate sentences. We're giving up that safeguard for what we think is the greatest power of rehabilitation. Incidentally, if we want to get into the philosophical question, I think we might consider sometime as the next possible evolutionary development, constitutionally, maybe an equal protection challenge to almost unlimited powers of judges. To vague powers for judges to levy sentences, the same type of challenge we're getting to vacancy and contributing statutes. The whole work is locked into it.
I would also have the observation that, without attempting to sound like Governor Wallace in any way, that I would think we'd be better off if we put subsection E as subsection A. We start off by saying the first purpose of the code is to ensure the public safety. I suspect we might maybe met with a little happier open arms.
Any other comments?
They're very close to the Michigan Revised Penal Code, the New York Code. it's the parts of the Model Penal Code that those states could live with the addition of the deterrence and the public safety features. And it omits a long string of things that the Model Penal Code had in it, such as the utilization of recent scientific developments and that kind of thing. That's about the size of it. In the red book here, the New York purposes and the Model Penal Code purposes of construction are set out in the Michigan and the Illinois. The Model Penal Code just rambles on considerable length.
On our previous discussion about the mental element in some of these offenses that are now outside the penal statute. Now, of course, as you can see, New York has a similar statement of purposes in its code. And then when they get to their area on culpability, their sections on culpability, they have a provision, section 1510 of the New York Penal Law, provides that the minimal requirement for criminal liability is a performance by a person of conduct which includes a voluntary act or the omission to perform an act which he is physically capable of performing. If such conduct is all that is required for commission of a particular offense, or if an offense or some material element thereof does not require a culpable mental state on the part of the actor, such offense is one of, quote, strict liability, unquote. if a culpable mental state on the part of the actor is required with respect to every material element of offense, since such offense is one of mental culpability. I would think this is, has been an attempt by the New York Code to deal with this, this question, the strict liability, mens rea, and the absence of mens rea elements in some statutes that do provide penalties.
Mr. Neeb, I haven't called on you for any comments today. Do you have anything to add?
I've been thinking along the same lines as Mr. Paletta on the possibility of, rather than having to go through all these regulatory sections, something to this effect, probably better to put it in the law.
Mr. Remley, do you have any thoughts on this particular section?
Well, I would agree with Mr. Neeb to that extent. I think New York does specifically designate that the culpability requirements that they outline will apply to chapters outside the code. But going to the problem raised at this end of the table about the unlawful act and the definition of manslaughter and a regulatory statute which declares, you know, leaving the door on the refrigerator to be an unlawful act which results, which under the Manslaughter Act could result in death, leads me to think that possibly there should be a distinction drawn between an unlawful act and a crime as defined in the code, require a crime requiring one of mental culpability and an unlawful act to be purely regulatory or mental prohibitive.
Good thought. Any other comment? That puts us back to that violation distinction, I think.
Back to offenses and violations.
Yes.
I don't know whether you want to amend all of them, but I'm speaking on that point. I simply do not see how you can avoid going through the 990 section. What are you going to do with one that I turned up that says the violation of this section is larceny by Bailey? You've eliminated the crime of larceny by Bailey. If you follow your substantive crime. I was a little astounded when I found that one. I don't know how many others there are.
I'm sorry, you're talking.
You can find no penalty that fits the penny system here because almost all of our managed to say that, well, you can only fine him $10, maybe you can give him 6 months in jail, therefore it's not a penny misdemeanor. So whether you amend them or whatever you do them, I don't see how you can avoid going through and actually studying them. I'm sorry, Tom, but.
Well, Chairman, regretfully, I think I agree with that, that all of them, to do an adequate job, that they're all going to have to be looked at. It's a horrible proposition, but eventually, I think it's kind of a duty to do so.
Well, I really lobby on the state on it.
No, I think that some of these other states have faced this same problem, and I can't recall offhand whether I read it in the New York commentary or Michigan or Connecticut. I know it has been mentioned that they recognized this problem and that when they went back to the legislature with their criminal code revision, they included a recommendation that a further study should be made in these other areas. But I think that we've got to keep in mind the direction that that has been imposed upon us by the legislature. And of course, it's a matter of interpretation of the act that created this body, I suppose, to a large extent. But it seemed to me that although recognizing that perhaps all of ORS needs to be revised and amended, that it is beyond the scope of the 4-year work of this commission, and that I think that perhaps we can get further direction from the legislature at the next session when we submit our biennial report. But I feel that if we have any hope at all of beginning to accomplish this task of amending the penal code or revising the penal code in the limited time we have, that we are going to have to recognize that certain things are just beyond the abilities of this commission in the time that's been allowed.
But yet the narcotics statutes are outside the criminal code.
Well, I don't think there's much of a problem in grabbing the narcotics and the DWI and negligent homicide and various auto theft situations, taking those directly. There you're talking about three or four or five specific chapters. We've got so much of a problem. They're easily recognizable and probably should be in the criminal code and so on. I certainly agree with Don. If we get into real estate and the insurance code and all this other business, among other things, you'll have every lobby in the state right smack on your back at the start.
Mr. Chairman, in spite of what I said, which I still think all has got to be done, that they've all got to look at, in spite of having said that, both Illinois and New York transferred a lot of purely regulatory material out of their criminal code, simply so it wouldn't be kicking around within it, which is pretty much what Don said further. So.
Any other comments? Any other suggestions? We're moving along very fast.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we tentatively approve Section 2, provided, however, that we that we make Subsection E, Subsection A, and move all the others down.
Any discussion? Have you thought how it would read that Judge Burns by making subsection E as subsection B? I don't know. I thought maybe A does have a more generality to it than the E.
Oh, I don't know. It makes quite a lot of difference where you put it. I don't feel very strongly about it, frankly, but all things being equal, it might give us a couple of points somewhere that would be helpful if you have that first objective. Near as I can see, all of these are equal objectives in terms of construction. The court reading it later, why the court would say, well, these are the A through G are all purposes, and presumably they're all equal purposes.
Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Okay. Is there anything else for consideration today?
Just our next meeting. I suppose before we commit to that, we should ask Mr. Arthur what his thinking is with respect to how soon he would be prepared to present further material to the subcommittee.
I don't have a calendar with me, but the week of the 26th or thereabouts, so does that start with thinking, Jerry? That's the August. I think I could be ready by a week starting August the 26th. I'd be a little more comfortable the following week.
Well, the reason I ask is because I think perhaps if we can get another meeting scheduled as soon as possible, sometime, say, after the next 2 weeks, perhaps we can take Professor Arthur off the griddle for a while and ask Professor Platt to step in. You've all received copies of his draft on responsibility.
How about September 3rd? This is the week school begins, and some of us still have some vacation hopefuls. We hope anyway.
September 3rd is all right.
It's Wednesday.
That's Tuesday, isn't it? The day after Labor Day.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Maybe then
about the 4th. That'd be there.
The 4th is one day in the week.
Wednesday.
The 4 days of Labor Day week is pretty difficult, I think.
I'd personally like to be sure of being here for the week, either the first or second week.
Well, you're leaving the last week in August is difficult because of vacation.
Trial.
Well,
Well, I think we'll probably run into difficulty the rest of this month, probably, in getting people here.
Your opinion is against Saturdays, is it not?
Oh, no.
Such as the 7th or September?
No.
How about the Saturday of Labor Day week?
Like that would be the 7th.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
September 7th?
Is that okay to get a member?
How about the last week of August? Is that a bad time?
Democratic National Convention?
Well, sure, that'd be the Saturday before Labor Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a long week. That'd be a bad. September 7th is fine, as I do.
Well, why don't we do this? It's all right with the chairman. We can schedule Professor Plant for that meeting. And we can be in touch with you in the meantime. But since we do have that draft ready to consider, I think we should plan to move on to that one and give you additional time if you do need it.
Well, why don't we plan to consider the Professor Plant's draft and then any additional material that Professor Arthur can get?
Great.
We're going to meet on Saturday. It takes 4 or 5 hours instead of 3, right?
Yes.
We got a lot of work to do.
Okay, that suggestion is fine. I'll just work it out with you. Anything else come before the subcommittee?
Might I make an inquiry?
Yes.
Would it be of any value to members of the committee if I were to pull 15 or 20 psychiatric evaluations from all the files regarding this question of responsibility?
I think it would be.
I was going to make one other suggestion on that line and forgot to, however. I had planned to send the draft to several psychiatrists, and I wanted to hope there wouldn't be anything wrong. We hadn't talked about circulating this ahead of time, but I've talked to several of people in Des Connell's office, and I'd like to send it to half a dozen of the psychiatrists who do quite a bit of the testifying in Multnomah County. Because I think this is an area we ought to have their help right at the very outset. We're in their ballpark.
If you can let us have
very good at both sides.
Would there be anything wrong, for example, with inviting two or three of them to come down to the subcommittee meeting?
I think not. I think we could easily take an hour in here.
As
long as you have a heavy gap.
Okay. I would be enlightened by it, I'm sure.
Well, let's remember then to get each one of us a couch instead of a chair.
After $35 in hand. Any other suggestions?
We have one to each side of the issue.
We join in the selection of the psychiatrist for you,
too. For adjourned.
Essence of what they had to say was that they thought that it was
bit indefinite, and they re-refer it back to this subcommittee for further study. Now, Don indicates here that we have some minutes for the 17th and the 27th of May, the 22nd of June, and the 13th of July, which we haven't approved. I don't want to take the time in the committee to read them, but I should ask, I guess, first that if anyone has any corrections or additions to make to any of these, or any observations to make with respect to what are in the minutes.
I move they be approved as reported.
Okay. So, second?
Second.
We second that the minutes listed on the agenda be approved as reported. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes have been approved. Now, Don, do you want to make some preliminary comments with respect to our second draft on arson? But maybe before you do that, you might have some general observations to make, maybe relating to the full commission meeting or whatever.
Well, you will shortly be receiving, haven't already. All of you should have received a copy of the minutes of July 19th. Commission minutes, which reflect the action taken by the full commission on the drafts that had previously been approved by this subcommittee. Now, I know that due to other commitments, several members of this subcommittee were not able to be present at that full commission. However, Senator Uturi felt that inasmuch as the approval for those drafts had all been, had already been made a matter of record, the subcommittee members and the MIDO's members, the commission proceeded to, at that meeting to consider actually five separate drafts that had been acted upon and tentatively approved. And out of the backlog of work that had been accomplished by this the commission tentatively approved everything that had been submitted with the exception of the robbery draft. And I feel there was probably some misunderstanding on the part of the commission with respect to certain parts of the robbery draft. Particularly the section on robbery in the first degree. And I think that's probably my responsibility and for not making it clearer to the commission members in the commentary that accompanied the drafts just what our intent was. But in any event, I don't feel that the objections raised by the full commission and the recommendations are anything that cannot be readily handled in redrafting. And I've attempted to take care of those corrections in this redraft. I'm not sure that I've accomplished that. But I think when we get to item three on our agenda, we can look into that further. But I feel that arson and robbery, and then our next big article, in the area of crimes against property will be forgery and related offenses, which will include the credit card crimes. I feel that we will be, as far as this subcommittee is concerned, a little ahead of our timetable with respect to crimes against property. And we should, within another 60 days, be able to finish the total section of the code dealing with crimes against property.
Do you feel that it might be expedited things if we go to robbery first rather than arson?
I don't think it makes any difference.
Well, we'll go with the agenda then. What changes did you make in the preliminary draft 2 from the preliminary draft 1?
Now, these changes
And I might say this, that the preliminary draft number two, inasmuch as these changes that have been made in the first draft reflect recommendations made by this subcommittee, therefore I have not revised the commentary which accompanied the draft, preliminary draft number one of July on arson. The changes that were recommended are reflected in the minutes of subcommittee number one dated July 13th. And page 8 of the minutes actually reflect, I think, all of the recommendations that were made. And what I've attempted to do here is to incorporate those suggestions. And assuming that we can reach a tentative agreement on the redraft, then the commentary will be revised accordingly before this draft is submitted to the full commission for their action. I think the first thing that was done in the draft under definitions, one suggestion was an explicit suggestion that had been approved and voted upon by the subcommittee, and that is under sub 3 of section 1. The definition of forest land has been changed. Now, the first draft, forest land, contained the same definition that appears in ORS in chapter 477, actually 477.01, contained the same definition that I had included for forest land in the first draft. The subcommittee felt that that definition should be amended by placing a period after the word clearing in the second line of the definition. And, so the amended definition reads, forest land means any forested land, woodland, brushland, timberland, cutover land, or clearing. Now, I recognize, I think, the point that was trying to make in that. I must say that I'm not quite satisfied with this new definition, particularly with stopping at clearing. Now, I'm not sure, and I think this would merit some discussion, whether or not clearing is going to possibly cause some difficulty.
Yeah, well, it is. What the hell is clearing?
You see, because clearing, as it was, as that word was defined in the in 477, read that forest land means any forested land, woodland, brushland, timberland, cutover land, or clearing, which, during any time of the year, contains enough allowable forest growth, forest refuse, slashing, or forest debris to constitute a fire hazard.
Where are you reading that from?
That's from the first draft.
First draft.
Now, is that taken out of the ORS?
Yes, that's precisely...
the one that's in 477?
Yeah, 477.01.
Right.
Contains the same definition. Now, I think the thinking of the subcommittee, I can't disagree with that. The thinking was that we could get into some reliable problems there, perhaps, and trying to determine when there was enough forest debris to constitute a fire hazard. But without that modifying language, I wonder whether it's inconsistent to say forest land means clearing. I don't know, and I'd certainly like to hear some.
I don't know what it means.
Every
problem I have. As it's stated now, as it's stated in the first draft, not as it's stated in the first draft. In my opinion, either when it burns or a guy setting fire thinks it'll burn or hopes it'll burn. And it doesn't really make any difference whether it contains enough stuff to burn at any given time of the year or not. If he sets a fire to it or
cause a fire to escape onto it at a time when he has reason to believe it might burn, or hopes it'll burn, why, he ought to be guilty of arson.
Yeah, but you got negligent burning here. Which would not include hoping that it would burn. Or thinking that it would burn.
Well, of course, forest land is really becomes important in section 4. Arson in the second degree, which is on page 2. That's where it really comes into play. I was wondering if there possibly be a problem as much as that you might have a clearing that never did have any trees on it or any kind of growth.
Does clearing by any chance, is it an old word that's been in the statute a long time that comes from when people used to speak of clearing all the time, you know, clearing for a cabin or clearing for a field?
I don't know. My guess would be it probably is an old word, and that's what was intended. It was intended to mean, I think, that an area that previously had trees on it that had been cleared off, either through logging or for some other purpose.
Of course, there's not going to be much damage to a clearing, is there? And it's a damage that can be repaired very quickly. We've got to burn up a bunch of 100-year-old trees may cause some long-term damage, but if you burn up a center burns on a wheat field, why, you don't, maybe a big monetary damage, but the next year you grow another crop of wheat on it. Crop of hay or something of this sort.
Hay.
Let me welcome Judge Rodman here, and happy to see you today. And
it's the second time this week.
Good. And want you to certainly feel free to participate in the discussion. And of course, that goes without saying as far as Justice Sloan is concerned. I was reading these minutes last night, and you have sure been a stalwart, and we're deeply indebted to your faithful attendance and participation. So. Well, do you have any suggestions, let us hear them from time to time.
Well, myself, I wouldn't think clearing has any meaning pertaining to this unless you define what you're talking about. Clearing which has just material on it or something. Because every place around here is clearing. It used to have trees on it, the whole line of valley.
Yeah, and according to some of our lawyers, each part used to be covered grass and I have the belly of a tall horse. Didn't have any safety.
Well, I'm not trying to run contrary to what this subcommittee had recommended at the last meeting, but I felt that I should raise this question that my own mind, as I read this definition, I just wonder if we may be creating more problems than we're solving.
Well, I was just wondering if you wouldn't pay to just drop the word clearing it. The other things you include, it wouldn't include all the things that you really are intending to protect. By our present forestry problems and forestry land and so on, I assume it's cut over land. If nothing else, not including a woodland or brushland. Wouldn't include what we would today be thinking of a clearing. The only thing to me I can think of, and my imagination isn't very good, that would be a clearing, in the sense of a clearing, would be maybe where the loggers would go in and clear off an area to put in their loaders and what have you. But other than this, you don't have a clearing as such consequence anymore. And I suppose there's many farms around this country that 50 years ago were clearings. You wouldn't consider them as a clearing anymore, they've long since lost that.
discussed this at the last meeting, but the basic question arises, and that is, we're not going to repeal the definition that's in 477.001, are we? That's in the forestry code, which was recently reenacted or revised. And so, isn't there some purpose in making our definition consistent with that, or is it not?
Well, that was my original intention, to make our definition of forest land consistent with that already appears in other areas of the ORMS. But my recollection of the discussion at the last meeting was that trying to prove whether or not there was enough flammable forest growth or debris to constitute a fire hazard. The feeling of the subcommittee was that this was creating unnecessary burden on the state and criminal prosecution. In fact, I think there was something that you need perhaps expert testimony to establish whether or not there was actually a fire hazard.
What about the legislative history of the revision of the forestry code as it related to that definition? I'm assuming there aren't any reported cases on this new definition, is that correct?
No, there aren't any cases on that.
I'd guess that any lawyer who wanted to go through words and phrases in the big version of Dixon, Webster could prove that forested land, woodland, brushland, timberland, or cutover land include clearings. I suppose somewhere in the state or somewhere else that there's some decision that said that that doesn't have to have trees on to be forest land. We could eliminate clearing, stop at cutover land. Wouldn't do any particular damage to the forestry code, would it?
I don't think it would affect the forest.
Get rid of our problem.
Well, actually, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, hold on.
Maybe you discussed this before, but the clearing that you now have in the draft is really much broader than the clearing that appears in the forest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it does. There's no
but
question.
We're not keeping the definition, we're enlarging it.
We're broadening it.
And that's, I think that's, at least that was my understanding. That's what the subcommittee wanted to do. Well, I was wondering if it's too, do you think it's too broad?
Yeah, I think
it's
well, it seems to me it would cause lots of problems. Trying to decide what is the clearing.
Well, trier of fact is going to have, or the trier of judge is going to be faced with a motion for a judgment of acquittal at the end of the state's case. With respect to the definition of clearing, if we leave it the way it is, much more so than we use the original definition, I would think.
What if we just leave clearing out? What's it going to do? What's it going to do basically?
Okay. Then we get cut over later. Seems to me that the last clause there in the original definition makes it plain that we're talking about forest situation, because they talk about which contains enough flammable forest growth, forest refuse, slashing or forest debris. That modifies woodland, brushland, and cutover land. Absent those, you might have an Eastern Oregon situation, Bob, where it's contended that it's brushland, but it's not forest brushland. And as I understand it, your thought, Don, you wanted to make this
forest might have ever been a high degree of arson on the way to set fire to the forest, right?
Well, yeah, that was what we were trying to do, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chandler's on the phone.
Now, if you'll refer to page 2 of the minutes, first two paragraphs indicate that there was a discussion about this definition, and Kathleen Bouffay asked why the definition of forest land contained the phrase enough planted with forest growth, etc., and suggested a period be placed after clearing. Whether or not the growth constituted a fire hazard, she said, would go to the question of recklessness and intention. Justice Sloan agreed that the language after clearing was superfluous, and Mr. Chandler commented that with the proposed amendment, the prosecutor would need to prove only that the fire started on the type of land described. Mr. Blatt explained that the definition of forest land was the same as that occurring in ORS 477-001 and was incorporated in 477-715, willfully and maliciously setting fire to forest land, and ORS 477-720 accidentally set fire to forest land. But that ORS 477-805 said that forest land, notwithstanding the definition of 477-001, means any land producing forest products. And forest products was defined in that section as including all products derived through the cutting, severing, or otherwise removing of forest trees and windfall. Of course, the only reason I mentioned that other section was to indicate there was more than one definition, but for the purposes of the arson type or the fire hazard definition, that it was the same as I included in the arson draft. But in any case, the minutes committee agreed to place the period after clearing.
If we
follow the old definition, the present definition as a preliminary draft number one, and a fellow sets a fire in a logging clearing, continues slash, escapes into it. If we go to the new definition, I mean, and he sets a fire in a logging clearing without, that contains slash, and it gets away from him and gets into a forest, all we can do for it with him is be charged with negligent burning him. If we stop after the clearing.
You mean where he has no intent? Yeah. I would agree with
that. I'll take back what I said a few minutes ago about clearing. I notice here there is a particular section in the present code on clearing rights of way and permits that are needed and so forth, and they refer to them as clearings and so forth. So it's apparent that the legislature did have in mind a specific kind of forested land.
Well,
so a clearing would include, I take it, they're talking here particularly for rights of way, for power, telephone lines, any other kind of transportation or utility or railroad and so on. There would be a lot of that. If that would be included as clearing, then that would be an important segment of the forest and land.
Has there been any tests on the present definition in the forestry code?
Not aware of. You didn't run across any case like
that. I guess the feeling of the subcommittee in the last meeting was that the part omitted was superfluous. It contains, I guess we thought that if it started a fire, it would have contained sufficient flammable growth, etc., to constitute a fire hazard.
In fact, it did start a fire.
Yeah.
It seems to me that for the purposes of the prosecution, no wonder, for second degree arson, for intentionally damaging forest land, have to prove that this was forest land.
The person commits the crime of arson in second degree arson, causing death or permanent injury, damage to forest land of another. innovating here. This is new as compared to the other codes. And it's new as compared to the present Oregon code, right?
Yes. Did you have a chance to look at those definitions of forest land in any of those other states we talked about last time?
You mean some of the southern states?
Yeah.
No.
Well, what's the subcommittee think? Should we come back to this after we discuss arson in the second, first degrees?
I think we're all agreed on what we want to say. It's just a question of whether we, in fact, said it here.
Mr. Spalding's had more recent experience than any of the rest of us, huh? Forested land.
Yeah.
Not criminal charges, but a lot of experience, anyway.
It was a little element of criminal law, certainly in that case I heard. First time I heard most express in the civil But aside from that.
I lean toward a broad definition. There are only probably three states in the United States, this one, Washington and Alaska, where forest lands are as important or have the potential of being as important to the people of the state as they are in Oregon. Lean toward a broad definition of forest land border. I found three fires this morning between Redmond and Three Finger Jack, new ones, 6 o'clock this morning. Not set by arsonists, but.
Spontaneous combustion?
No, I like to start last night. I think that tend to the old-fashioned view that lots of people don't commit crimes if they know they're crimes. Might tend to be a little more careful if they realize that forest arson is a pretty broad crime in Oregon and would be prosecuted rather vigorously.
So, you leave it as it is?
I tend to leave it as it is.
I don't think it hurts anyone just to leave that word clearing in there. It's, I doubt if anybody will ever prosecute anybody for firing a clearing. They'll have some use out in the other words. Well, in forest land, just the ledge forest.
Unless it's a very small, closely contained fire on a new gas line right away or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tend to feel that the phrase which was deleted from the first draft is superfluous?
Read it again.
Well, it says, forest land means any forested land, woodland, brushland, timberland, cutover land or clearing, which, during any time of the year, contains enough flammable forest growth, forest refuse, slashing or forest debris to constitute a fire hazard.
Yeah, well, that limits it a bit.
Yeah, it limits it, but is it not also superfluous? I mean, if you have a fire, it obviously contains enough to constitute a hazard.
Not necessarily forest debris, though.
No, it does limit it more. There's no question about it.
So you could have a fire in a clearing that
didn't
burn any forest material.
But you could have a fire in a clearing which is cleared for a couple of years and suddenly going up to blackberries in a dry area, forest or bracken or grass or any one of 9 or 10 other things that would be a real fire hazard.
And contiguous to a forest.
And be right in the middle of the forest.
Sure. I think it's superfluous for any purpose.
Well, it seems to me that if we're going to proscribe forest fires, a fire started in a clearing adjacent or contiguous to a forest, a clearing that doesn't have any slash or debris in there, is just as dangerous and should be, and there should be a strong sanction on that.
Well, there's a gasoline tank there.
It's an abandoned fire, sir. Place a lot of forest growth by a commercial standard, or forest products, which, of course, clear.
Okay. Question that I suppose probably plagues us is, assume that this is up in Deschutes County and in the middle of timber culture. Is that clearing within this proscription?
Well, it's either clearing or forested land. Timber culture, forest.
Forested land. Yeah.
So, you got that coming soon. 40 minutes got no way out.
I told them. Some of my TA acquaintances, if my experience in this committee pressed me about how prosecution minded Mr. Spalding was, and then they just were happy to hear that.
That's where I started out in criminal.
Since it's in the subcommittee, then that we should believe it the way it is.
That makes sense.
All right. So, what about the subs 1 and 2? Are there any changes, Don?
Yeah, there are. Two is not changed. Two is the same as appeared in the first draft. Now, number one, I changed, although this particular change has not been voted on by the subcommittee. I thought a good suggestion had been made with respect to the definition of building. Justice Sloan had objected to the use of the word structure as it appeared in the first definition. Definition saying that building, in addition to its ordinary meaning, includes any vehicle, boat, aircraft, or other structure adapted to overnight accommodation of persons or for carrying on business therein. And the objection was well taken to that, but it implies that vehicle, boat, aircraft, structures. I have modified that in ordinary draft number two so that the definition of building now reads, building, in addition to its ordinary meaning, includes any structure, vehicle, boat, or aircraft adapted to overnight accommodation of persons or preparing on business area. And I'm interested in Justice Sloan's reaction to that. I felt that would be an improvement in that reference.
I got a problem on this. Saw a lot of boats yesterday that weren't adapted for overnight accommodation persons for carrying on much of the way of business therein, but wouldn't be very pleasant for the owner thereof if somebody came along and set fire to the gasoline tank and burn it up. My airplane, I can't stay in it overnight. It would be off. It's a great deal of discomfort, I suppose. And I guess I carry on business therein when I come over to a meeting of this committee in it, but I don't, that's kind of car, car, I can't stay in it overnight. I suppose I'd carry on business in it, but I haul somebody around in it that I talk business with. But doesn't this definition, as it is now, limit vehicle, boat, aircraft to such time as it's got some specific adaptation for it? And I didn't read that into the first draft.
No, I think that hasn't been changed from the first draft. And of course, that's for the purposes of first degree arson that we're talking about now. Now, in your hypothetical, if someone had set fire to another type of boat or something, if as a result of that, somebody was placed in danger of bodily injury,
building of another was placed in danger of damage, it would be second degree arson. And in the absence of either of those two factors, I think you'd have to fall back on well, I don't think it'd be negligent burning, but I think it would be covered under criminal mischief.
No.
Yep. Intentional damage of property of another.
It kind of bothers me to say that a boat is a building. You know, define the word building as including things that are not buildings in ordinary English.
Well, the purpose of that was to protect human beings, and the purpose of first degree arson